Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas. Today, I'm joined by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you, sir?
Very well, thank you, Nicholas. Greetings and ahoy.
Very good. And also Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you doing?
Nick and Gabriel, doing well, thanks. Looking forward to hopefully a good start of the week with the two of you on the show today.
Indeed. And I noticed that I tripped over my words like 14 times in the pre-show discussion, so I apologize if I do in this intro. But anyway, with that aside, let's dive headfirst into the news of the week. And one of the big stories here is Eskom's continued claims that sabotage is to blame for many of their woes. So, of course, Eskom has many problems. Old infrastructure is part of it. But increasingly, the line is being put out there by News24 in particular, but also by Eskom, of course, itself, that sabotage is a major component now in Eskom's inability to deliver enough electricity to the grid. So at Matala Towers Power Station on Sunday at Unit 1, power was cut to it. And what is the fourth incident of suspected sabotage at the power station in the last 2 weeks? That on Sunday, officials discovered the cut cable, but it hadn't actually fully tripped because there was a backup cable that hadn't been slashed, but three other cables in the same rack were also undamaged. Nothing was stolen. There were also sabotage incidents at Tatuka Power Station, where apparently a cable was cut, and it was in a sort of out-of-the-way area that took Eskom officials days to find, as it was far outside the range of the CCTV cameras. A warming valve was found cut with a grinder at Tatuka Power Station in a separate incident. And this was also away from the CCTV camera's reach. Eskom believes that these are deliberate acts of sabotage by someone who had access and knows the security features in the area quite well. News24 reported that the reactor earth bars and flexible copper cables were removed from three units at Hendrina Power Station. Officials discovered that parts were missing in the early hours of Friday morning when attempting to start up the unit that had been out of commission for maintenance. So, firstly, I guess my question to you, Gabriel, is how credible are these claims of sabotage? And further from that, what could be motivating this? Is this contractors maybe seeing if they can get work to repair these? Is this, as the ANC might put it, as we'll discuss later, counter-revolutionary forces at large trying to undermine the efficiency of the state? What do you think is behind this?
Obviously, it's the CIA and Mossad.
Obviously.
What else needs to be said, right? So I think the point with that is that we might be in a little bit of the boy who cried wolf situation. So in the Zuma era, it really did become quite embarrassing the extent to which the white monopoly capital conspiracy theory ended up being fleshed out by allegations, for example, of sabotage sponsored by the American government and the Israeli government. I mean, it was clearly like the Yes.
Right. Can I stop you right there? There was, I believe, it may be an Mbeki era one. What's his name? White communist guy, Alex someone, I think, who famously declared that a bolt that had been found in Kuburg Power Station's turbine or something was deliberate sabotage by someone. I think that was the first time it made headlines. And I remember it was all over the front pages of the country.
This is a Zapiro cartoon with the boss.
Yes, yes. Yeah, exactly. Making fun of this because it's like how ridiculous that sabotage could be going on in our power stations.
So I think that, you know, I think it's been a lot of the boy crying wolf. And so it is hard to take seriously. When I first came across the story, I literally rolled my eyes. But I think with the details that are laid out of the kinds of things that have happened, it doesn't seem like rocket science. It seems like a dude with not pliers. What do you call the bolt cutters and a bucky
and angle grinders?
Yeah. Three dudes, bolt cutters, bucky, angle grinder. And you could do, all of that good stuff. I think Alec Irwin is the right one. Thank you, Moonchild. The right reference. So it seems plausible to me insofar as A, it's simple enough that I can believe it. B, the material evidence insofar as it's being honestly reported by News24 is, it doesn't seem confusing like the allegations last year and in 2020, it seemed like it could just be breakage. It could just be bad weather. This seems different, or it could just be theft. Again, this seems different. But for all that, it's hard to say for sure. I'm still kind of cynical. Is this contractors looking for work? Maybe. I mean, for sure, I've seen that in central Johannesburg and spoken to ward councillors sort of, you know, stretching a lot of West Johannesburg who have shown me evidence of that kind of thing. My favorite one, I think, Nicholas, you saw the video with me, was on a smaller level. There was electricity stuff, but there was also the guys who were the picky tub agents who were stealing picky tubs.
Right, the bins.
And then also in the business of selling the picky tubs to the people who would then call and say, well, we don't have a picky tub. So you can have inside jobs like that. Yeah, one wonders if there is a political force that is sufficiently disciplined to go ahead and break things without stealing. That would really be news. And I suppose that may be why the story matters, because it's not clear that's what's happening, but maybe it is.
So just to clarify, it was, of course, Alec Irwin, who was the Minister of State Enterprises, Public Enterprises, back in 2005. So I was like 13 or something when this story happened. But that was actually in our first round of load shedding. So our very first round of load shedding was apparently blamed on sabotage, which is quite interesting. Chris, what do you make of this? Who do you think is behind this? What do you think their reasoning is? What else do you have to add to this?
Just a broad point, I do think Eskom has been sabotaged by misguided ideology and policies for the last 15 years, making operations and just basic maintenance, all of that sort of stuff, is disincentivized by perverse sort of outcomes, quote unquote, that they want to achieve. That's simply what happens when you have the wrong guiding management policies and ideas in place, when you don't focus on actual outputs in terms of energy delivery and that sort of thing, but when you focus on ticking boxes in certain ways and you focus on other agendas and ideas for how state-owned entities should be used and shaped and transformed and unfortunately bad direction. I mean, it's probably better to treat each case or alleged case of sabotage on its own merits and investigate whether it's legitimate sabotage or not, whether it's just useful for smoke screens and that sort of thing. But I think the idea of the boy who cried wolf is very apt, because South Africans have simply been fed these stories too much over and over and been asked to swallow them whole. You know, eventually all credibility goes out the window. So it's difficult to say, I think, exactly what the truth is at this point in time. But just another useful way in some ways to distract from the SOE's failings instead of the maintenance, the basics being done.
Right. No, I think that's part of it. And look, you know, I for one do believe that there probably is some sabotage, some nefarious stuff going on here. I know that that kind of accusation has long existed at the municipal level, as you just pointed out, Gabriel, but also with regards to the power utilities in particular. They were notoriously rumored in at least in Joburg, and I'm sure every other city. I remember on the Daily Friend show, we covered a story a while ago about a Durban power officials being accused by community members of purposely sabotaging stuff. So it wouldn't surprise me if this was being done for kind of profit. But once again, you know, we're in this bad situation because we have a police service that doesn't work properly, because we have an Eskom that isn't run properly. And those bigger underlying problems, these are all just sort of symptoms that bubble up because of that. Gabriel, any final thoughts? You're muted, sir.
Ah, I sabotaged myself for effect. So we've looked back over the last 15 years. Yeah, so like half our lifetimes of load shedding and excuses for load shedding. Including sabotage. But you can go back further. And I do remember when I first joined the Institute, I can't remember who said it first. I think this quote has been attributed to Gareth van Onselen and Frans Krenier and many other people. But it just does seem to, it turns out to be a fact that the ANC has managed to destroy more power generating capacity running the government than it did in several decades of being a revolutionary force trying to blow up power stations. when sabotage was the official policy, right? And it's just worth remembering that part of the reason you might suspect that they're, firstly, that it so quickly jumps to mind, things aren't working, let's come up with an excuse, sabotage. Also part of the reason you might think that there could actually be a revolutionary out there who uses sabotage to get their political ends is this. And I say this, very carefully, don't tell your friends unless you trust them. It just is the case that if you really wanted to trigger a July riots type situation again, you would knock out the grid. I think you just need to take out a couple of power stations because we're already only producing 50% of total capacity. You take out a couple of power stations just for a couple of hours, and that could shut the whole thing down. And my understanding is if the whole thing is shut down, it can be very difficult to turn it back on, take days, weeks, maybe even a month. Yeah, and in that period, you would really get very excited. So it's not to be entirely dismissed, this thing.
Yes.
It could be practiced. That's the kind of worry.
Helen Ziller, I think back in the mid-2010s, may have written an article actually about this, about what a total blackout would look like. And basically, as far as I understand, the problem is if the power grid gets overloaded at any one point, and this is why we have load shedding to prevent the overloading, then they have to shut all of the power stations down to cold and then get them started back up again. And that takes a minimum of 2 weeks. So you can imagine literally the whole country having no power for 2 weeks.
Yeah, very exciting.
Yeah, no, very much
it
so.
It would be the most
Your mention of revolutionaries is very good because that provides us to a great segue to talk about the ANC. So Thabo Mbeki, former president, has ripped into the ANC's Eastern Cape elective conference, saying that it was just a scramble for resources and had no substantive elements to it. So Thabo Mbeki said, according to my calculation, I may be wrong, the conference does not discuss policy. The conference did not discuss organizational reports because it was busy with credentials. It's a big battle about credentials. Why? Because the principal task of the conference is to elect me, and me being whoever's standing for election. I am quite certain all of us are very worried about what's happening to the movement, and given the place of the governing party since 1994, the impact of what is going wrong within the movement and its impact on the country. That's why when people look at the totality of municipal votes last year, nominally the ANC got less than 50%, the masses of our people are making a statement about the ANC, and this is a very serious statement, said Mbeki. Referring to the Eastern Cape, he said, when you try to look at the matter, it's not policy, it's not ideological differences, it's not about whether we are a broad church or not, it's entirely a scramble for positions to get resources, entirely. He then goes on to talk about a story where
ANC... You can just read that last little bit again, though.
Yes. So just to clarify, here's what Thabo Mbeki, former leader and president of the ANC, said. When you look and try to resolve this matter, it's not policy and ideological differences. It's not about whether we are a broad church or not. It is entirely a scramble for positions to get resources, entirely. Which is something we have been saying for a while. So I'm glad the former president agrees with us. So he then goes on to talk about a story about how an ANC member from Newcastle in KZN messaged him saying, me and my local ANC branch didn't campaign for the ANC in the municipal government elections because the IFP asked us not to. And we agreed with them because we think that the municipal government in Newcastle has hitmen, and the ANC government has hitmen on its rolls, and we're not willing to campaign for an organization that is literally paying assassins. Now, who knows if that's true or not? But the point is, there's a profound feeling of sadness and despair.
Are credible in Newcastle. Yeah.
Indeed they are, as we know, because of how much political violence there is, in particular in KZN. And this coincides, I think, with something we also want to talk about today, and we can talk about these a little bit separately here. The Umrabulo Policy Conference. The ANC last week put out this 180-page document talking about its plans, its view of the balance of forces in South Africa, and it includes many different analyses about what's gone wrong. Some of them are quite honest. Some of them get sidetracked by other issues. I saw there was a part in the policy document where the ANC says that, look, we know that the National Party infiltrated counter-revolutionary agents into the ANC in 94 and surely some of these must still be operating within the movement, which explains some of the counter-revolutionary behavior we're seeing. They gave other reasons as well, to be fair, but I just thought that was funny. So anyway, I've waffled a lot, Gabriel. What do you make of former president's comments on the ANC?
Yeah, so I think it's very telling. There is something about Thabo Mbeki's career which is strange. One of the factors is that he was by far the most popular ANC president. He got almost 70% of the vote, with the highest turnout in the 2004 election that anyone has ever had in South Africa. And a wise political party would have tried to turn him into a Ronald Reagan, would have tried to airbrush his mistakes and emphasize his successes, which were partly to cut the debt in half with a very disciplined financial minister, set up an economy that was ready to grow, and in fact, which did add 1.9 million jobs, oddly enough, between 2003 and 2008, which is oddly enough the same number of jobs we lost between 2020 and 2021. This is not what happened with Mbeki. Instead, he was totally frozen out. Only the bad sides are remembered, and there were plenty of those, to be sure. Most curiously, Mark Gafisa, who wrote A Dream Deferred, I think the official biography of Thabo Mbeki, and if not the official one, the sort of unofficially official one, wrote a piece in the Sunday Times last week in which he said, well, you know, the funny thing about Thabo Mbeki is that he might seem like the good guy before the Zuma Ramaphosa era of lost jobs and corruption and no economic growth. But in fact, Mbeki sowed the seeds for all of this, partly by shielding the corrupt, by protecting Jackie Celebi from Vusi Pikoli, defanging the scorpions and then destroying them, etc., but also by planting the seeds of race-based policy, which would come to be implemented right at the end of that 5% GDP growth era, around 2007-2008, into the teeth of the financial crisis, and which clearly shifted the scope of South African public service as well as the private economy, incentivizing rent-seeking corruption and all kinds of nasty things from, you know, white people, colored people, Indian people, and black people, all of the stars of the president's keepers being very rainbow, but really stealing a lot of money from the tax base, which meant it was difficult for poor South Africans to get by and difficult for middle-class South Africans to keep working. It's a complicated legacy, and that's the point of the ANC, is that, you know, like any individual, it does have a good side, it does have a bad side. I think people who emphasize that in an election year tend to try to say, as Peter Bruce did in 2019, that you should vote for the good side of the ANC and hope that by giving it a confidence boost, the bad side will reform. That's crazy. But in an off election year, as we are in now, I think it is worth noting that there are clearly contests within the ANC, that Thabo Mbeki is chastising a thoroughly corrupt organization with all of the authority that his previous successors, however caveated they may be, with all of the authority that he bears. What could possibly be more damning? And as a South African who is excited by the idea of us becoming a robust democracy, which means seeing power transfer peacefully through the vote, I'm very excited to hear Thabo Mbeki say that. I'm sure that there are many South Africans that will never take me seriously, that will never take any three of us seriously, that will take him seriously. And they might very well change their voting behavior on the basis, not just of what he said today, but also the evidence of no reform that they see coming tomorrow. And that makes me think, don't give up hope. Don't give up hope on this country. As long as stuff like that's being said, there's a game to play. There's a fight that could be won.
Indeed. That's a very important thing to remember. Chris, your thoughts on the former president's comments, but also on the ANC's policy document. I know you also had a chance to have a look at little bits of it. Another thing that stuck out to me was talking about learning from the successes of the coronavirus pandemic rollout and instituting some of the achievements and communications and organization that they had learned from that into general governance structures, which strikes me as a little bit not quite on the money.
I suppose diverting money intended for communicating about a deadly virus to personal sort of benefactors in the form of digital vibes is a success, if one considers that to actually be successful or not. I think swelling your own bank account for some people is successful, you know, whereas for others, maybe it's not what the money should have been used for. Just the document itself, lots of sound and fury signifying nothing. 188 pages of flowery language, but nothing in terms of actual reform. I'm kind of surprised that there wasn't more credit given to things like Spectrum auction, for example, which are told as reform, but in actual fact, you know, there's no scrapping of BEE, no reform of labor markets that would help 46%, the 46% unemployment rate on the expanded definition to actually be resolved. Nothing of stopping things like the Employment Equity Amendment Bill, which is just BEE on, you know, even more steroids kind of thing. None of that. So it's all, oh, you know, we acknowledge that things are bad, but we aren't actually going to change. So don't get too excited. So the document itself, I think, in a way, it's useful because it shows you just how directionless the party, the organization has become. So hopefully it becomes clearer to many more people just how directionless the party is in reality. And then just on the former president's comments, yeah, maybe a certain level of frustration with what has happened with his glorious organization. Maybe one sees in moments of frustration people, their true thoughts, you know, sort of what's coming out when they see what happens at party conferences. So yeah, instructive in that way as well. And I think, as Gabriel rightly says, many people definitely won't listen to any of the three of us, but they will see in those words and the way that he sort of has carried them over that frustration with the party, and they'll maybe start to think, you know, maybe it's time for a bit of a change.
Just to once again advertise the reading that everyone should go read, the Umrabulo policy document. It's got this great line, page 18. The ANC remains the biggest party in many councils where it is not governing. However, the bitter reality is that it has been kept out of government by the growing phenomenon of small opposition parties ganging up to keep the ANC out of office. These coalitions, which have less in common than a crowd of drunkards in a beer hall, are on a crusade to obliterate the defining goals of our national transformation project.
Can I follow that up by saying national transformation project? I'll just add to what Chris said that there's no direction if what you're looking for is improvement, like positive direction. But there really is direction if what you're looking for is some redefinition of purpose. And it is Marxist. It's overtly saying, you know, capitalism is the problem. The lumpen, the people who make money and keep it for themselves and are just trying to take care of their families, they completely confuse, as always, capitalism with corruption. So we all know corruption's a problem. But then in this document, it gets rephrased as capitalism. And then the answer to the problem is socialism. And I think that it is going to be very important to look into this policy conference coming up. This is the preparation for that. I think if this is not changed, and it's not likely to be changed very much, it's going to set up the ANC manifesto for 2024. And I want to quote Sihlen Gubesi from the Big Daddy Liberty show last night, who said, you know, if it doesn't change, the ANC manifesto for 2024 is going to be the longest suicide note in political history.
Also possibly the most badly written suicide note, because while some ANC documents do have a little bit of flair, like this one, describing the opposition as a crowd of drunkards in a beer hall. And, you know, it's not quite as, shall we say, romantic as our wild dogs analogy, but I quite like it, I must say. It's describing the opposition. Anyway, let's move on to our last story for today. And this is about the city of Joburg. The city of Joburg is today hosting its first ever energy indaba, and the gathering is bringing together energy experts to discuss the city's desire to reduce its dependence on Eskom and plans to partner with independent power producers. So this is a presumed Joburg and its coalition government trying to follow in the footsteps of Cape Town, and it's the DA government there in moving away from ESCOM, reducing the impact of load shedding, and hopefully eventually making themselves independent, at least in to a level that makes a difference from the national energy grid. Mayor Paul Palazzo gave the opening remarks. She said that the Indaba would be used to support the city's sustainable energy strategy, and that the city planned to add an extra 475 megawatts of capacity from alternative energy sources such as natural gas and solar in the next 15 years. So it's quite a long-term plan. In some more comments she made, she said that Joburg needs 26 billion rand to stabilize the power supply in Joburg. So I presume that includes not just generating more electricity, but also maintenance, repairing infrastructure that's gone rotten. I know, for example, in a lot of parts of Joburg, especially older parts, the underground cables have so decayed that they effectively need to entirely be replaced. And this 26 billion rand looks very far away because the entire infrastructure budget is 7.7 billion rand per year, and that includes water and refuse services. So, looks like the city of Joburg's in a bit of a pickle. Let me start with you, Chris. What do you make of this?
Maybe useful to get information just how bad the situation is. I think, rightly so, ratepayers and citizens are very frustrated when, for example, a period of load shedding is supposed to end, and then because of an onrush of current, because of lack of maintenance, substations can't handle it, and then they go off again for a few days or hours, you know, that sort of thing. So at least now we get a bit of a glimpse in terms of how bad things are. It's difficult to see it being, number one, the adequate amount being raised, but number two, as well, it being administered properly. That's, I guess, part of the balancing act of coalition government. That'll be an issue going forward. And we've seen problems up until this point with coalitions, but when you have those underlying fissures maybe exposed by more stresses in terms of rolling blackouts, then maybe you're going to see even less progress being done ultimately. So I wonder how long those coalitions would hang together when exposed to these sorts of things. Yeah, I don't think it bodes well for the city, unfortunately. Go ahead.
I must say, I like the chutzpah in putting forward a 15-year plan for a shaky coalition that's barely holding together. But I like it. I like it. It's good.
They could have had more chutzpah. You don't do the Indaba. You just say, what is the cheapest, best way to do this? And then you say, this is what we're going to do.
Right. So, Gabriel, this is exactly what I want to come to you on. In the last sort of 2-3 minutes here, you have some concerns that they're maybe not be tempted to not do this as cheaply as they should.
Yeah, I just know from like pretty grade 7 level research, which I think is all it really takes to resolve this question. Maybe I'm wrong. That the IPP costs of producing electricity in South Africa are significantly higher than the coal-fired power generated stuff. Okay, even though the latter is being run by an extremely inept government. And the reason for that is that solar just hasn't gotten to the space where it's as cheap as coal or gas. So, you know, if you're Swedish and you're in Sweden or you're in Japan or you're in some country where you have enough electricity to always be able to turn on the lights, then I really do think it's very nice for you to go ahead and try and find the greenest solution. And if the Germans... The Germans seem perfectly happy to have electricity twice as expensive as their sort of neighbors because they've gone super green. Fine. They still have enough electricity. We don't. Okay. I would like everyone that's, decently paying for it or whatever needs it to be able to turn on the lights, to have a heater that's working, to have a factory that can operate reliably, to have a business like, the one that we work in where you can stream without worrying about being cut out halfway through, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'd like that to be resolved first by getting the cheapest possible option immediately before we get too fancy for ourselves. And the mix that was described coming out of this Indaba is just clearly not the cheapest possible mix. I know that a lot of people in the DA don't see things the same way. They want to go for like the slightly more expensive version that also feels more sustainable, looking forward to 2050. They can accuse me of being too short term, but I think if you don't solve the problem, that ESCOM creates by putting a ceiling over our GDP growth. And it really does. We produce as much electricity as we did 10 years ago, and we produce as much as everything else as we did 10 years ago. We've not managed to transition into being like a super high-tech, low-energy economy. We need the furnace to burn. And if you don't grow our economy, the population keeps growing. That means the anger keeps growing. And that means the powder keg gets drier and drier. Next match comes, next winter comes.
Right.
There's no room left to be green once you've blown everything up.
Right. We're going to have to be worrying more about violence and food than, you know, where our power comes from. And everyone will be running off of generators then anyway. So yeah, let's avoid that future.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's avoid that future if we can, if at all possible. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. That is all we have for today. We hope to see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Please subscribe to the show. Please rate us on the podcast apps, and please like the video. Anyway, that's all for today. Thank you very much, and have a great one.